The Guardian.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen, sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's guest is Marilyn Robinson, who joined us to talk about her Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Gilead. It's the letter of an aging Congregationalist minister in rural Iowa to his young son from his second marriage. It's written as a loosely connected series of thoughts, memories, and religious homilies. It has no chapters, but is simply divided into two parts. Robinson is an active member of the Congregational United Church of Christ in Iowa, as well as an academic. She teaches literature, creative writing, and sometimes theology. Book Club Supremo John Mullen told her that her book was unlike anything else in contemporary literature. He wondered if a strong sense of religious belief could be an advantage in structuring a novel. Or, as he put it, is it useful to have God in a novel?
The idea of God, or the faith in God, gives life a purpose. You know, the primary purpose being, of course, self-awareness. How do you understand reality in a way that can be reconciled to certain basic assumptions, and you know, the basic assumptions of Christianity, basically, that your life matters, that everyone else's life matters equally, that, you know, to use a phrase from Calvin, that we're here to be instructed. Every new experience is an instruction in the meaning of human existence. And so a great deal of alertness is called for, a great deal of scrutiny of present and past experience. I think that in the modern period, people have actually kind of toyed with the idea of that things are not meaningful, you know. I think that a religious consciousness knows how to invest a reality with a serious meaning, no matter what the religion in question is. But certainly if it's one that requires you to understand and to behave humanely toward other people, it fills virtually any casual moment with a lot of purpose, a lot of meaning.
And Calvin's a sort of bête noire of kind of Western culture almost, but he actually cites Calvin as a sort of source of insights and even kind of rather poetic metaphors.
American culture is very routinely called Calvinist, even by Americans. People talk about Calvinist influence in Britain also because of the influence that he had on the Church of England during its formative period, and because so many of the traditions like mine, Congregationalism, are Calvinist traditions that basically drifted across the Atlantic, sometimes with a certain haste and urgency. Nobody reads Calvin. That's one of the things that's absolutely fascinating to me, because he's thrown around as a major term what made, you know, American civilization particularly what it is, you know, and our great New England writers are often looked at through this lens, and if they say something humane and profound, it must be a resistance to Calvin rather than a heritage from Calvin. I was teaching Moby Dick, actually, and I thought, you know, this book is charged with theology, and I should look at the theology he would be responding to. That was the first time I had read Calvin in any significant quantity. I read the Institutes and Moby Dick side by side, and there the conversation between them is clear and powerful. Calvin is a metaphysician as much as he's a theologian, and his metaphysics is very beautiful, and it has descendants in people like John Locke.
I suppose what he's famous for is the doctrine of predestination. And there is actually a bit in the novel, isn't there, when Jack, who says to Ames, "What do you think about predestination?" He swerves away from it. He says, "Oh, I've thought a lot about that." And that's a reason for not talking about it, rather than, which is kind of rather characteristic of him.
Yes. Well, you know, the thing is that Augustine was predestinarian. Ignatius of Loyola is predestinarian. Thomas Aquinas is another one, you know. The only major theologians that I'm aware of who are not predestinarian are John Chrysostom and John Wesley. And the reason for this is that the issue comes up very frequently in Scripture, and people that are highly Scripture-oriented simply can't really evade the question.
I mean, I suppose the other unusual thing about Ames as a narrator, which quite a lot of critics were surprised at or obviously unused to, is he's a good person. How do you write a really interesting and absorbing novel, not just about, but narrated by a good person? He's actually been kind of nagged by a less than sort of elevating human emotion. He's worried that this guy is going to go off with his wife.
You know, the whole impulse to write what he is writing is a protective impulse, you know, trying to give his son a father in the way that he can do it, etc. He realizes that he's jealous of Boughton simply because he's young and he can play baseball and his family seems to love him and so on. But it's also true that he's not somebody that you would want bringing up your child on the basis of what he does know about him. You know, I mean, he's a pretty shady character insofar as John Ames is aware. And so it's a double thing. It's simple human jealousy and regret on the one hand, but it's also a kind of paternal protective anxiety on the other hand.
But you keep back the main story of the girl that he's got pregnant and that he's abandoned. You keep that back, although Ames knows it from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. He has done a terrible thing, and it's exactly the thing that would just alienate John Ames, because he has basically allowed a child to die. You know, he had a family that was perfectly willing to protect the child and so on. And the great sorrow of John Ames' life is that he has no child, you know. And so that's a particularly grating offense, an offense in itself, but one that he feels particularly sharply.
And the form in which John Ames writes this and inserts this story, it's not very many have done this, which has no chapters. It has little breaks, but it doesn't have sort of... It has one big break, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. There are two considerations, really. One of them is that I tend not to write in chapters. I forget the whole chapter issue. And the only reason housekeeping has chapters is because my editor put them in. And the other thing is that... For my purposes, it's a very clearly artificial imposition on the voice. John Ames is not writing chapters, you know? And so just from the point of view of not creating something that, at least from my point of view, jars with the life of the voice, I couldn't put them in.
Did you have a chronology in your head while you were doing it?
Only in the most general way. If you know someone, if you know a living person... You find things out about them, you know, because something reminds them, it occurs to them to tell you, you know. And there's not a strict order in the way that people reveal themselves to you. It's never like that, you know. I think of John Ames as someone who basically has spent 40 years thinking on paper. I mean, it's a little bit like a letter that got away, you know, but it has these sort of sermon habits imposed on it of, this has happened, how can we understand this, you know?
Sermon is almost always used pejoratively in English.
Mm. One thing I know is that there are a great many clergy of every stripe in America, because they always come up and ask me to sign their books. And they very often say, I don't know what to do with my sermons either. But many of the people say, he reminds me of my pastor, he reminds me of my father, I'm also a third generation pastor. They're pervasive, you know, and they're extremely valued culturally. And the fact that they are always disparaged, they're always ridiculed, they're always charlatans. It's a very odd thing. But in America, the churches teach self-discipline, you know, civic responsibility and all the rest of it.
Well, you give him some other sort of literary, other things that he quotes and is interested in. And he reads John Donne, this guy, and he reads Feuerbach.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, he kind of seems to know about Marx and Freud and things a bit as well.
Yes. Feuerbach, I read and included because so many ministers I know, they just dashed against the stone of Feuerbach when they were in seminary. and have spent the rest of their lives trying to deal with Feuerbach, you know. So he made a very eloquent and for many people, extremely powerful sort of alternate explanation of religious belief, you know. And he's a classic text in seminaries because he's a problem for many people.
One of the things that he talks about a lot, one of the religious words he uses as the experience he's narrating, I wonder if you'd tell us a bit about what blessing means, which is a word which is kind of has become sort of devoid of force, I think, for many of us, but seemed to acquire a kind of electricity in this book when I was reading it.
You know, I've gone to the same church for about 25 years in Iowa, and one of the things that I notice watching it as a phenomenon is that people love the benediction. Mm-hmm. They feel blessed, you know? It's a very striking. You know, when you think about it, there's something kind of fantastical about the idea that one person can confer such a thing on another person, you know? If you were to ask them what it meant, they probably couldn't tell you, but if you ask them if they feel it, if it's important to them, they would say yes. Why is it that some people are sort of set apart to be efficacious in that way? It's just interesting and beautiful, you know?
And clearly the blessing at the end, the blessing for that he wants to give, that he gives to Jack Boughton. I mean, it is, I guess, the prodigal son story.
Oh, I mean, that's a very great parable. It really is. You can think about it over and over and over again. Just shift the weight of the narrative a little bit one way or another, and it becomes another thing, you know. And
the critic Robert Alto, who's written a book about the influence of the Bible on narrative prose in American literature, and there's quite a lot about you and Herman Melville. He's talking about Ames's own habits of narrative, and particularly the way that he strings ands together. That's like a lot of King James Bible prose. I don't know whether Marilyn Robinson is just so steeped in it. It came naturally when she heard this.
I wanted him to be someone who would, of course, have been saturated in his own major literature, you know. But at the same time, I'm sort of saturated in his major literature. So, you know, I don't have to put things together particularly consciously.
On the one hand, often it's can be very plain and colloquial, but he has these funny flights of fancy as well, which he often says, as if. And that's a little signal for some sometimes descriptive or sometimes interpretive, but often quite fanciful little diversion.
One of the things that he wishes that he could do is to confer to his son, from the perspective of his old age, how strange and beautiful experience is, and the most modest, the most colloquial forms of experience. Another thing is that his grandfather's life hangs over him, and his grandfather is really, he's not modeled on one figure, he's modeled on a lot of figures who came out of the Second Great Awakening in the United States, who actually had profound visions of Jesus, and they would see him in chains, and then they would go to the Middle West, or they would go somewhere and they were abolitionists. Always these visions are leading people toward abolitionism, it seems like. But in any case, it was an amazing generation of people who founded colleges, places like Oberlin and Grinnell and so on, which are very famous, at least in the United States, are absolutely the work of these same people who started wonderful, enlightened institutions all over the Middle West. But anyway, I don't know of any population quite like them, because on the one hand, they were absolute religious visionaries. On the other hand, they were people who had divinity degrees from Yale in many cases, and knew Greek and Latin, and were profoundly disciplined, and they were people who could have had, you know, a comfortable existence in New England. They dropped everything and went out into nowhere, you know, and lived hand to mouth while they were teaching their Greek and their Hebrew, you know. Really absolutely wonderful people. But the thing that's amazing is that they were truly propelled by these great visionary experiences. They were powerful people in the sense that what they did in their lives was astonishing. And they wrote beautifully, typically, you know.
But anyway, it is well time for me to throw it open. Anybody here? I think we have the dreaded travelling mics, I'm afraid.
Thank you for such a wonderful book. And also being a Baptist minister, I have a whole stash of sermons up in my attic. I don't know what to do with either.
I swear, it's the and major like literature of the 21st century.
But actually, the question I wanted to ask is one of those as-ifs, as I've just discovered that, because it's on page 65. Just absolutely, I mean, every page was... Well, he talks about in eternity this world will be Troy, I believe.
Ames loves the world so well that he can't believe that it will perish and be forgotten and that it has no place in the ultimate value system, you know. And that also while he, you know, because of his metaphysics makes him look at difficulty and acknowledge it and all the rest of it, but he can't say that it's meaningless, and he can't say that it's simply absorbed into some greater benignity, you know. And so he uses the idea of, you know, the great tales of suffering, which are the human epics, you know. I reread Gilead because, you know, I wrote it actually quite a long time ago. And it's strange because when I was writing it, I felt as if I were creating Ames's mind. And now I realize that I've sort of absorbed Ames into myself. And I keep finding ideas that I thought were my ideas.
How do you go about beginning to create that voice, that lifetime's wisdom in a character as you come to think about writing him?
When I came to Iowa, I wanted to feel like I lived there. And I did what I do. I did pretty elaborate research into the early settlement and all the rest of it. And then, of course, I have been, that's my religious tradition, and I've, you know, which I've been affiliated with my whole adult life. So a lot of things come very naturally to me in the character of John Ames. But I would not have thought that I would write from the point of view of a male narrator. But there he was. I have not had extensive experience with baseball, but he did, you know. And it's a kind of an uncanny experience. I use the analogy of dreaming, you know, simply because when you're dreaming, very often some person emerges in the dream that you is no one you know, no one you've ever seen before. You know a great deal about them, you know. They're ominous or they're reassuring and maybe they have a characteristic scar or something like that, you know. Or you're in a house that has rooms and rooms and rooms and you think, why didn't I know this house was here? You know, this kind of thing. Your mind just spins these things out. It's something the same in fiction, except, of course, you have to discipline what you're doing, you know.
I suppose I'm wondering how John Ames would be counselling the president as he goes for re-election. Perhaps the issue, the comparable one to abolitionism, is gay marriage.
Well, one of the things, you know, that you would never know from listening to the uproar that surrounds so much American politics is that Obama and I belong to the same denomination. We both belong to the United Church of Christ, which is the Congregationalist. And his church in Chicago is no doubt still so much respected that the young people from our church were sent to Chicago to study this church, you know, see how things were done. You know, people talk about, you know, what is this man? You know, is he Muslim? Is he? No. He and I spoke at the same religious gathering, you know, his audience being bigger than mine. But everything that he does makes perfect sense to me. You know, I'm perfectly at ease understanding where he stands in terms of religious issues. My own church has blessed gay marriage for years, and now that it's legal in Iowa for that kind of marriage to occur, we marry gay couples all the time. So he was a little behind the consensus of the denomination, a little bit, you know. There's a sort of quietism about our religious tradition, you know, our denomination. I've sort of violated the rules by, you know, putting us out in public like this. On religious grounds, he could not be at ease parading his religion. And that makes a conundrum that some people just can't deal with.
He's going to vote Republican, isn't he, Ames? Or if he lives long enough.
Yeah, well, yes, he will. But, well, he's A, in the Middle West, B, descended from abolitionists, who are all Republicans on account of Lincoln, and C, Eisenhower was much, much better and wiser man than anyone called a Republican now.
First, I'd like to say that the effect that Gilead and Home have had on my spiritual life cannot be measured. But I believe at some point you talked about theology. Because its starting point is a belief in God, it is free inside that to do very special things that maybe philosophy can't do, or because it's argument and it's trying to make a point, often try to score points as well.
It's probably true. Well, one of the things that theology does is concede the importance of every life and every experience within every life, which is enormously liberating. Because, when you look at a lot of modern writing and the meaninglessness seems to be the point, you know, and people are dismissed as hollow, trivial, etc., what you're saying is, I will not see. And if you assume that these things, you know, that the apparent blandness or insignificance of anything or anyone is only apparent, and that you're the fool if you can't see past it, you know, it's enormously stimulating to have that kind of implied obligation in what you describe.
I wonder whether you could tell us something about Home and Gilead. I mean, it's absolutely riveting that you decided to take up the story from a different perspective and to tell us the same story in a different story. And I wonder whether when you had conceived of Gilead, you also were thinking about Home, or whether the impulse to write Home came out of what you had thought you hadn't told us yet in Gilead.
When I wrote Housekeeping, which was, you know, by far the first thing I'd ever published or ever actually completed, for a long time afterward, I went through mourning, you know, because you really, you know, you live with these characters and they, so I thought that was just how it was, you know, and so I wrote Gilead and I finished it. I went through mourning. I thought, well, now the mourning begins, you know, and it will end. And then I thought, why, if these characters continue to be in my mind and matter to me, and by implication, if they have lives beyond the lives I've described, let them have their book.
Behind several of the questions that John asked you was a kind of sense that this is a book that talks about religion to non-religious people.
Well, I'm very gratified that it, you know, that it makes people think, you know, at the levels that are deepest for human beings to think at. I write what you might call sort of unpublishable books. You know, I mean, I know if I'd gone to my wonderful editor in Manhattan and said, I have a great idea, I'm going to have a minister dying in Iowa in 1956. He'd have been very kind, and he'd certainly have suggested that I rethink. So I'm kind of furtive about what I write. What might look like, you know, preemptive self-defeat in the conceptions of these things makes it a very sort of private exercise. It matters to me what I write. I mean, I'm engrossed in what I'm writing, emotionally committed to it. If someone were to say at the end of the day, there is no market for this book, you know, this is, we still love you, etc., that would not be a bad thing. What would be a bad thing is if I calculated a book, you know. If I want to be opinionated, and I've been known to do that, I write an essay.
But a lot of people have talked about reading it very slowly. It's really very meditative, I found. And I just wondered, what were your influences?
Authors are my models?
Yeah.
I am super saturated in 19th century American literature. It's just the affinity that I feel for it is off the charts. But I don't consciously model anything I do on anything. When I have a voice, I have the novel, basically. And the thing that is so amazing about it is that it dictates. Therefore, certain things are excluded, not possible, not consistent with the voice, you know. It guides you and it limits you very strongly. And every once in a while, you know, you lose this. And so I wrote something that Jack said, and I put an exclamation point after it. And then I had to go to work. And I spent the whole day thinking, what if I die? I couldn't wait to get home to take that exclamation point out.
And I'd like to thank all of you for coming, and thank Marilyn for talking to us.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen is sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar. Cornish cheddars made with over 60 years of knowledge, time, and skill. To find out more, please visit davidstowecheddar.co.uk.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.